You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Tara Lohan. She's an environmental journalist and author of the new book, Undammed, Freeing Rivers and Bringing Communities to Life. Tara has been writing about the confluence of water, energy, and biodiversity for nearly two decades. Her work has appeared in The Nation, The American Prospect, Salon, and other major media. She's the editor of two books on the global water crisis, Water Matters and Water Consciousness. She joins us today to discuss her new book, Undammed, Freeing Rivers and Bringing Communities to Life. Welcome to The Exchange, Tara.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
So what inspired you to write about the revitalization of environments following removal of dams?
Well, I had been working as an environmental journalist for a while. And as you mentioned, I tend to write about the intersection of issues, especially things that overlap with water. So I've been writing for a long time about energy issues and water issues. And for a while, that was mostly chasing how our water was being impacted by efforts to get harder and harder to reach fossil fuels like fracking. And I found that I was reporting on a lot of things that were really difficult. I was meeting people that were afraid, that were seeing their communities, their rural communities being industrialized by fossil fuel extraction. I was seeing water polluted. And I spent a long time working on that and talking to these folks and also tracking how, you know, climate change was getting worse and biodiversity loss was increasing. And over a long period of time, that really started to take a toll on me. I don't know if there are folks that sometimes have days where they don't want to read the news, but I started to feel a little bit like I didn't want to write the news sometimes. And it was reporting on dam removals that actually helped me find some good news stories. And I think that when I first started looking at them, it was a lot of how dams were being removed to help fish populations and wildlife, which is really important. But the more I looked at dam removal stories, I also saw other really sweeping benefits for all kinds of wildlife and for water quality and for public safety and cultural resources and climate resilience. And I found that really compelling.
Well, you seem to dive personally deep into your subject matter. I mean, you opened your book describing yourself on a bike trip along a river in Washington by yourself. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so the Elwha River runs through parts of the Olympic Peninsula, and there were two dams there that were constructed about 100 years ago, starting in the early 1900s, and they are in a mostly undisturbed watershed there. Part of that is Olympic National Park. It's also the homelands of the Lower Elaklom tribe. And those two dams were removed around 2011 to 2014. And I visited about 10 years later because I wanted to see how that watershed and that river had responded after dam removal. And one of the dams, the former dam sites, was pretty easy to get to. But one of them took a little bit more effort to get to. It's in the national park. And the river had actually washed out part of the road that used to get to the dam site. So I was riding my bike through the woods for part of that time, and then later along a road that was a little bit easier. But it was pretty astounding to get out there and to see where this several hundred foot tall dam used to stand. And it just so happened that I was there on a very blustery, cold winter day, and I was the only person around. And it was a very moving experience to be there.
Well, as I was reading your book and learning about the Elwha River that you open up with in chapter one, and all the way through to the story of the Klamath River that you capture in chapter 9, I was amazed at how you write with the skill of a novelist and the details of a journalist, which really makes your book an educational joy. I'd like, if you would, to read an excerpt from your introduction.
Sure. In the nearly 20 years I've been working as an environmental journalist, I've mostly seen forests uprooted, mountains blasted, and water polluted. For years, I covered the fossil fuel extraction beat, visiting pipelines, gas fields, oil fields, coal mines, and those living beside it all. I still remember the stomach-turning smell of the fumes from oil and gas wells when I visited with a landowner in Colorado who had lost his sense of taste and his health after he leased his property for fracking. I also wrote about the West's diminishing water, including the Colorado River Basin's growing aridification, the unhappy union of climate change and drought. When I turned to wildlife, how are they coping with all of our development, pollution, and climate change? Much of that wasn't good either. Along the way, I wrote stories about dam removals. They were an odd bright spot on an often bleak reporting landscape. Not surprisingly, I began to realize that dam removal stories were my favorite ones to write. And other than a big hit I had about the environmental consequences of our obsession with really soft toilet paper, they also tended to be the most popular among readers. Soon my dam removal stories began crowding out everything else I was writing. It was talking to researchers about the ELWA that made me realize why. Dam removals offer us a pathway to begin undoing some of the harm we've done. In a world of rising temperatures and shrinking biodiversity, that's critical for nature and people. For me, it's been a kind of lifeline, an antidote to my crisis fatigue and snowballing environmental grief. I'm looking forward to a reporting road trip where the highlights are seeing free-flowing rivers, paddling newly created water trails, and celebrating environmental justice wins. That's part of what led me here to this river and what has led me on a much longer journey across the country to understand a growing dam removal movement that's resulted in about 2,200 dams blasted and backhoed from U.S. rivers, most of those in the last 25 years. It's an extraordinary turn of events for a dam-loving country.
Well, America certainly does have a lot of dams. How many did you find in your research there?
Well, the National Inventory of Dams, which is managed by the Army Corps of Engineers, lists 92,000 dams, which is the number that's most often quoted. But that actually only accounts for dams that are a certain size, and generally that's over 25 feet tall, which is quite large. There's another inventory, a National Aquatic Barrier Inventory of Dams, which takes into account dams of all different sizes across the country, and that number is actually at over 500,000.
That is amazing. And in your research, did you find any delineation between which, what percentage of those dams are publicly owned versus privately owned?
You know, for that 500,000 number, it's not delineated yet. But I think the majority of dams are publicly and privately owned. Few of them are owned by the government. Most of our dams are large dams or federal dams, but most of the dams that we have are not federally owned. And many of them are owned by private entities. That also includes municipalities.
Okay, so would it be fair to say that the vast majority of the dams in America are private ownership?
I would guess that from the 500,000, because many of those are small dams and many of those are would be private dams that are on, you know, owned by companies or just landowners.
My guest is Tara Lohan. She's an environmental journalist and author of the new book, Undammed, Freeing Rivers and Bringing Communities to Life. Tara, tell me about this dam problem in America. Why were so many built and how were they funded and what impact do they have?
When European colonists arrived in North America, they pretty much began building river barriers like dams and weirs right away. And much of that was to produce some sort of power. They powered mills to grind corn and to also produce leather goods and metal goods and stuff like that. Everything they needed was water powered for a while. And eventually that became hydroelectric power. But there was initially, you know, a lot of dam building, tens of thousands across New England and then down the East Coast and then westward. And of course, as we built dams over time, they got bigger. Many of the dams that were built later in the West in the 1900s were quite large. But across the East, we have a lot of very small dams and a high proliferation of dams, so much so that at this point, there are some states where they say that the majority of dams that they have are actually what they call deadbeat dams, which are dams that are still on the landscape but actually aren't serving any purpose anymore. And so the impact on that right away, there was a conflict with fish because they blocked the passage for fish. And that was, you know, an issue that we're still trying to resolve to this day, how we balance the purposes that for dams, you know, the needs that they serve for us in terms of water storage in some places or hydroelectric power in other places versus the harms that can be incurred from them as well.
Well, you wrote that in a 30-year period during this dam building time, 1,700 dams per year were built. Really?
Yes. yeah, I mean, we built a lot of dams, particularly in the 1900s. And I think the impact of that we're seeing now when we're talking about removing dams is that many dams are licensed, you know, for a period of time, hydroelectric dams, usually about 50 years. And we're starting to come to terms with the fact that we have had modern environmental laws, you know, since the 1970s. And we're realizing now that some of these dams that were built before that time are no longer really in compliance or able to operate with the standards that we see now for what we want for our rivers and streams. And so that's why I think we're seeing more conflict or more conversations about whether the dams that we have on our landscape, many of which are olding, are aging, are dams that we want to continue to have.
Well, the dams extracted wealth from the natural resources and environment. Tell me about hydroelectric power, irrigation, food production, municipal water infrastructures, and recreation, all because of these dams.
Yeah, so I mean, dams have served many critical purposes. I think if we look across the West, the irrigation that we have, a lot of that is because of water that is stored in reservoirs from dams and then used to irrigate. I think a lot of people, when they think about dams, they think of hydroelectric power, but actually only about 3% of our dams produced hydropower. And in some places, dams are built to store floodwaters, but many dams are not built for that purpose at all. And we're seeing dams in New England that are being removed now because they're actually making flooding worse when we have storms that are coming through now that are larger in size than when these dams were built. So I think that when we're looking at dams, they can serve many purposes, but they don't all serve all of the purposes at once. And so we have seen areas where, like the Pacific Northwest, where hydropower is really important, but we're also seeing areas where, you know, dams are used more for flood control.
And recreation.
Yes, and definitely in recreation. And sometimes what happens is after a dam is built for something like hydropower and that power is no longer profitable, the company, or it's used as a mill dam, the company moves on and the dam remains and it becomes the recreation feature, is sometimes a byproduct and it's what's enjoyed by the public afterwards.
So how did the tribal nations over the past century or so respond to the building of so many dams?
Well, I would say that tribal nations, first off, weren't consulted when dams were built, and they saw great impacts to their lands. In some places, tribal land was taken in order to build dams. Land was flooded where other people used land for hunting and for gathering resources or for areas that were important for ceremony and community connection. And the decimation that dams caused in some places to fish runs has really negatively impacted many tribes on both the Atlantic and Pacific coasts. Fish are good sources of protein for people, but they're also salmon for Pacific Northwest tribes are also really important for family and community connection and spiritual practice. So the loss of fish can affect everything, including the sovereignty of those nations and their cultural and spiritual health.
Well, these dams were produced for profit, and that profit benefited certain human communities. But at the same time, they also destroyed the natural environment, as you talk about, and communities of plants, communities of animals, communities of fish that humans depend upon. Isn't that cycle going to come back to hurt us?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's at the heart of this conversation about dam removal, is trying to find a way in which we're thinking differently about our relationship to the natural world and our relationship to our rivers in particular. We have asked a lot of our rivers over the last couple hundred years. We have taken a lot, and we have, at the same time, from an environmental perspective, lost a lot. We depend on our rivers. So the more that we are harmfully impacting our rivers, we will feel that. We need healthy rivers. We need healthy ecosystems in order to have healthy communities. And I think we started seeing that, with the Klamath dams. I know that y'all have reported on that a lot, but we were seeing, dams that were producing hydropower, but they were also causing problems with not just loss of fish runs, but there were water quality problems that resulted in toxic, harmful algae blooms and other impacts like that. So we see that when we are not looking holistically at our relationship with rivers and how they impact not just, wildlife, but also our communities, we have an opportunity now to shift that thinking a little bit. And I think we've been seeing that for a couple decades now in a lot of ways with river restoration projects of all kinds, but I think dam removal fits into that as well.
Well, I'm encouraged by your book because it sounds like we're on a trend the other way. We're starting to recognize the damage and starting to remove many of these dams. And in fact, you report that just in the last 25 years, more than 2,000 dams have been removed. And I want to get into that part of the story, but we need to take a short break. And we'll be right back with my guest, Tara Lohan. She's an environmental journalist and author of the new book, Undammed, Freeing Rivers and Bringing Communities to Life. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Tara Lohan. She's an environmental journalist and author of the new book, Undammed, Freeing Rivers and Bringing Communities to Life. Now, Tara, we talked about the problems that dams have made throughout history. And now there's this new trend. Dams are being removed. But as you said, there are more than 93,000 major dams and more than 550,000 other types of dams across the country. Over the past 25 years, a couple of thousand being removed sounds like a drop in the bucket. What do you think?
Yes and no. On the one hand, when I look at the projects that have been done and the impacts on the ground, I actually think it's quite astounding because there's a huge ripple effect when you remove dams. But I also think you're right. We have a long way to go. And even if we just looked at only deadbeat dams, these thousands of dams that actually don't serve any purpose at all, but are still in our landscape, we do have a long way to go. And I think it's important to put that in perspective. But it's also important, I think, to celebrate the wins that are happening too.
Well, you open your book with a lens on the Elwha River in Washington, but you close it with a focus on the Klamath River and its new journey from Oregon through Northern California to the Pacific Ocean, following the largest dam removal project in American history. Tell me about that project and its aftermath.
Yeah, so after about, 20 years of work by tribes along the Klamath River and other folks in Oregon and California, environmental organizations and state and federal agencies and all sorts of folks, four hydroelectric dams were removed on the Klamath River. Most of that work on the ground was done in 2024. These were four dams that were owned by PacifiCorp that produced a small amount of power. And they were removed because they were up for relicensing and they needed to be able to pass fish by them and they couldn't. And when they looked at what it would take to build fish passage to get salmon around these dams, they realized that it would cost more money than removing the dams and returning a healthier and freer flowing river, which also helped other problems, like, as I mentioned, the water quality problems. As water was warming behind some of these reservoirs, it was causing algae blooms. And so the dams were taken down. They started in 2023, but most of the work was done in 2024. And it was a huge project, as far as we know, the biggest dam removal project that's taken place. It required draining three major reservoirs, and that opened up about more than 2,000 acres of land that has been, I would say, expertly replanted with seeds and for grass and forbs and other kinds of plants. An incredible, incredible effort over the last couple of years that has gone into trying to transform this landscape that was, initially when the water was withdrawn, looked very muddy, and has now become an area that's really flourishing ecologically and will continue to do so in the years to come.
Well, it sounds like, from your description, that they made the decision to remove the dams through a lens of commercial profit or loss rather than proper stewarding of the environment. Now, I have a question about the tribal nations that tried to warn the federal government about the critical water needs of fish during the water wars after the turn of the century. You write about President George W. Bush, who visited Oregon in 2002 to reassure farmers that they would get the water they needed. What happened?
Yeah, so in 2001, there was not a lot of water in the Klamath Basin, and because of protections for fish in the Klamath River that were federally listed as threatened or endangered, water was cut off to farmers and ranchers in the upper basin in order to ensure that fish populations would have enough resources to survive downstream. The following year, and there was a great uproar from communities in the Klamath Basin who depended on that water for their farming and ranching needs. And they were the ones that were assured by the George W. Bush administration that things were going to be different. And the following year, again, there was not a lot of water. Tribes downstream, particularly the Yurok tribe at the mouth of the river, warned that if there wasn't enough water released, that the fish that were coming back weren't going to have enough cold and cold water and also enough water to be able to get upstream to reproduce. And water was limited for the river and distributed for irrigation in such a way that when the fish came back that year in 2002, there was a massive die-off, I think unprecedented anywhere. I've heard from 30,000 to 70,000 adult salmon died in the lower reaches of the Klamath River in the homelands of the Yurok people. And it was absolutely devastating. And I mean, the tribe were against the building of the dams and had long fought their existence. But this, I think, was a really, really galvanizing moment for tribes along the river and also for other folks that were really now starting to see what some of these impacts could be from dams.
But Tara, that's an amazing visual. 30 to 70,000 fish just died off. What did that look like?
From folks I've talked to, I mean, it looked and it smelled horrific. I mean, there were bodies floating in the river that was carnage. I don't know an easy way to say that. I think for anyone looking at that, it would have been horrific. I think to be a person from the Yurok Nation for whom the river and these fish are relations, it is absolutely devastating.
Well, the dams blocking the Klamath River today are gone. So what's happened to the environment since?
Well, it's good things as far as I can tell. I was there in, so the last dam infrastructure was removed in the end of the summer of 2024. And I was out that year on the river in December of 2024 with some folks from tribes and nonprofits in California state government that were researching what fish were coming back and where they were going. And folks were absolutely blown away by how quickly the returning fish that fall moved past where the dams had been up into what they called the reservoir reach, and then immediately began finding tributaries off of that area where, you know, they hadn't been in over 100 years. And so we were out there. Folks were catching fish with nets to try to identify, you know, what species were that were coming through. They had sonar cameras that were counting the bodies of these fish passing by. There were people that were out looking at after the fish had spawned or if they were making nests and counting those. And so there was a lot of folks that were out tracking fish that were coming back. I think initially that fall they had said that about 5,000, but I think it ended up being more than that even that first year. And this year it's been even more fish that have come back and they've gone even farther. There are two small dams above where these dams were taken out, and the fish climbed these not very, very good fish passage ladders there and made their way into, and some of them through Upper Klamath Lake and even to tributaries above that. And it was not really known if that was even going to be possible. So that has been really encouraging news. It'll take, you know, a lot longer for, you know, these generations of fish to be able to increase in number. But the fact that they're finding this new habitat is really exciting. As, you know, rivers warm with climate change, being able to find these smaller streams and colder habitat is really important for salmon and their long-term survival. There also was pretty immediate benefits for water quality, a reduction in toxic algae bloom and lowering of temperatures in the river. And that has also been regarded as a really good sign that happened right away.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. My guest is Tara Lohan. She's an environmental journalist and author of the new book, Undammed, Freeing Rivers and Bringing Communities to Life. So, Tara, you talk about fish returning. The Klamath River is, what, 250 miles from Oregon through California to the Pacific Ocean? Fish are navigating that?
Yes. yeah, absolutely. It seems like a long way to go, but they are absolutely navigating that area. And I think they're finding more and more habitat that they need. It's not just the length of river that certain fish need certain kinds of habitat. And so for salmon, finding areas where streams are cool, where there's gravel, that where they can build nests is really important for their long-term survival.
Well, you seem optimistic about the capability of environments to recover in short periods of time, even after many decades of destruction from these dams. What evidence have you seen in the biodiversity in other places that inspires such confidence?
Really amazing things. One of the first dam removal projects that got a lot of attention was on the Kennebec River in Maine, and this was the Edwards Dam in 1999. And that was removed, and just upstream from there, a few years later, on a major tributary of the Spasticook, the Fort Halifax Dam was removed. And they have seen an enormous rebound in a lot of different kinds of fish. They have 11 native species of sea run fish there, those that go from the river to the ocean and back. But most amazing has been the river herring so far. There are two species of those, alewives and blueback herring, and they have come back by the millions now. I was out there looking at the return one spring, and literally millions of these fish coming up some small waterways. They spawn in lakes and ponds, and to watch them come up, I put my phone in the water to try to get a video of it, and I could just feel their bodies bumping against my hands. I mean, the whole was bank to bank full of fish. And they have alewife festivals where the communities come together and they celebrate these fish, and there are eagles all around, you know, hunting it from the treetops. And it's been a way in which people have come back to living in relation with the river there. I mean, the rivers where, you know, this happened in Maine, where places were, you know, there had been a century of dumping chemicals and all sorts of things into the river, and people had turned their backs on the river. They had built homes and businesses that didn't even have windows facing the river. And now there are communities that are gathering on the banks. They're celebrating fish. There's sturgeon that have been returning in better numbers, and they are literally leaping out of the river. And there are places where people have set up Adirondack chairs to just sit and watch the river and to see these fish coming back and to see them being healthy. And it's been a really encouraging thing to see.
Well, I can sense your passion about the environmental resilience and capacity of these rivers to return and recover in a short period of time. What inspired your interest in environmental issues? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up on Long Island. I spent my summers in the Long Island Sound. And then I went to college in Vermont. And that was where I first dove into environmental writing and you know, I guess I had known about Thoreau and these people from a while ago that wrote about nature. But I started reading people like Terry Tempest Williams and Rick Bass and Gretel Ehrlich and lots of contemporary environmental writers. And I realized that there were lots of ways you could write about what was happening in the world around you and share those stories with people and the places that you hold dear and try to hopefully inspire people to, if not love the place you live, then love the place that they live.
Well, you also spent some time here in Oregon.
Yes, I now live in Bend, Oregon. I've been here for 4 years, and absolutely am enjoying this wonderful place.
Did you get a chance to study at the University of Oregon?
Yes, I did. I spent 2 years in Eugene and participated in the literary nonfiction writing program there.
So what's your hope for the ongoing dam removal movement across the country?
Well, I hope that it continues to grow in scope and scale. I think what's been exciting to me is seeing that each dam removal leads to more dam removals. I think once people see the impacts of what happens and the benefits that can happen, it inspires other projects. But I think on a practical level, there's also this cumulative technological and scientific information that gets passed on that makes things easier and makes things better. But I think also there's an accumulation of the good that comes out of it, you know, when we're seeing healthier rivers and healthier forests and healthier communities. And that accumulation, I think of as hope, is really wonderful to see. And I hope to see more of that. But I also think that at the heart, these are also projects that are really about people. And to me, seeing people work together to fix things right now has been really inspiring. And I think at a time when we have no shortage of reasons to be divided, seeing people come together to work on these projects feels really important. And I hope we do more of it.
Well, we have about a minute left. And speaking of people, what lessons can we learn from the indigenous tribes that continue to serve as stewards of the land?
The biggest thing that I took from talking to folks from the Yurok and Karuk tribes is they have an understanding of living in the world as being people who fix things. And that's trying to participate in the world. You know, I think we can participate in our environment around us to try to make this place that we live a little bit better every day. And sometimes that is a really long project. I mean, the work that Indigenous people have been doing on the Klamath River, you know, the 20 years that it took to remove these dams, that was a long time, and that work is not done for them, and hopefully it's not done for the rest of us either.
Well, it sounds like it's a drop in the bucket as we start the dam removal movement, but that drop can turn into a lot more, as we can see from the rivers themselves. So really appreciate you taking the time and pouring your energies and your skills into this book. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you, Tara.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
My guest was Tara Lohan. She's an environmental journalist and author of the new book, Undammed, Freeing Rivers and Bringing Communities to Life. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.